Welcome to Flipping the Script. I'm Lindsay Cuiava, your host and the artistic director of Ree Theater, an online theater and education consulting company. Each week, we bring you new episodes about the theater world and theater education in an effort to revolutionize the way that theater is seen at the school and community level and inspire you to make art that matters wherever you may be. Hey, everyone. Welcome back for another episode of Flipping the Script. Oh my gosh. Okay. So a few months ago, I had the opportunity to sit down with Jim Hoare, and I am so thrilled to be able to release this conversation that we had. So if you've been to any kind of convention or conference regarding theater or theater education or community theater, there's a very, very good chance that you have met Jim. So Jim is the vice president or executive vice president of education and community initiatives for TRW, which is Theatrical Rights Worldwide. And he is just an incredible human who has so, so much information and knowledge and experience. And so I asked him if he would come on the podcast and just talk about his career as both a theater educator and now as the executive vice president of TRW. So as soon as I got to TRW, Jim and I started talking and he started just sharing these incredible stories. And so this episode kind of starts abruptly because Jim and I had been talking for about 30 minutes before I just said, oh, you know what? I should just turn the microphone on because all of these stories and all these things that you're sharing would be so inspirational to educators. So there's no formal introduction because Jim and I have been talking for so long prior to me turning on the microphone. So it kind of just starts pretty abruptly. We start talking about theater and how he did casting practices, and we just kind of go from there. Before we started the episode, I had talked to him about Les Mis and about some other productions that he'd done. So he references our previous conversation. So don't worry, you didn't miss anything in the episode, but there is some reference to that. So just as a red flag for you all. We also reference a previous podcast episode a few back in December. We released an episode with Paul Kanan from Take It From the Top. And so Jim and I talk a little bit about Paul as well. So if you haven't listened to that episode, you should definitely go check that out. But yeah, so if you ever have any questions about theatrical licensing or anything like that, I highly recommend reaching out to Jim or reach out to us and we'll put you in touch with him. He has so much gold that he provides in this episode to folks who are either licensing material or even, I guess, anyone that has ever worked with shows and is not sure why changes are made, what the legality around things are. And Jim just does a really great job of being super accessible and open about these things. And that's how he is to work with outside of just this interview as well. So without further ado, let's go ahead and get to this super inspirational and informative conversation.
After about 20 years of directing high school theater, I found that the easiest way for me to do a show was I no longer selected the show before auditions. I used to love to put scripts on my desk in May or June of shows I had no intention of doing, because then the rumor mill would start all summer and the kids would be precasting the show that we were not going to do.
Right.
But I got to a point where I said, no, let's just have auditions. Mm-hmm. Everybody come, sing, do monologue, sing a song, learn a dance combination, and we just saw who showed up. And from that audition, I would say to myself, all right, now what cast just showed up? We'll do that show.
That's really smart. And then how far in advance would you have to do that? Like, would you have to have the auditions?
We would have auditions in September, the second week of school.
Okay.
We would cast the entire school year from that audition.
Oh, wow. Okay, because so you did more than just, like, one show.
Ultimately, at the end, between dance concert and Shakespeare and improv shows, we would doing 10 a year. One or two musicals, dance concert, Shakespeare, student-written one-acts, drama, comedy. And then we had an improv team that performed almost every month. I also learned inadvertently because I became a big fan of improv back in the early 80s when it was really just taking off. And I went and I saw a couple of improv troupes perform in New York. One was a group called Sills and Company, which was Doug Sills, which is the son of Viola Spolin. They were just really fun and exciting, and I started doing it with students. And then there was Freestyle Rep was in New York, as part of New York Theater Sports. And then when we went to the Thespian Festival back in the 80s, Mike Rock from Comedy Sports was performing at night, the late night. And that's where my students said, we need to do this as like a show. So we started doing improv shows. And when I went to Freestyle Rep in the city at one point, there was a guy there running their show named Mike Rock as well, and not related to the first Mike Rock, which I thought was interesting. And he said, "Well, our goal is to be funny half the time. So if you're at an improv show and it's funny half the time, that was a success." That was a huge weight off the shoulders of my students and I, because we realized everyone doesn't have to hit it out of the park. And you used to watch Whose Line Is It Anyway on TV. They might tape the show for 2 hours for the 22 minutes that you see on the air, because that was always brilliant, because you saw the best. But what happened was doing improv also lets kids realize failure is part of the process. It's okay to fail, and it's, you learn from it and you move on, and it's sort of built in. It's acceptable. But I also found that improv attracted more boys to my program. I had quite a few boys who said, "I came to the improv show when I was in eighth grade or seventh grade, and I said, I want to do that." This was a long roundabout answer to you asked about Les Mis.
Yeah.
So in 2000, I believe it was, so I'd gone into the city to see Steve Spiegelbeck in the late 80s, and he started sending me things, and that was good because sometimes he would send me scripts that were not great, and I won't tell you what those were. My grandfather always said, compliment people in public and criticize them in private.
Yes.
but then we got to do some really fun things, and like we did in 91 or 92, I believe, I had seen Once on This Island on Broadway, and I said, we had a multi-ethnic school, which was great because you could do more variety. I said to Steve that I loved the show and I really wanted to do it. I had the right kids to do that show, but I would want to do a multi-ethnic version. And Lynn Ahrens wrote a multi-ethnic version. If you ever do that show, on the back of it, it's for a multi-ethnic cast. Because the essence of the show is about rich and poor. And so we did that show. I ended up taking that. So we were the first high school production of that. And I took that to the International Thespian Festival when it was in Muncie, Indiana. 17-hour bus ride from our school, but it was a wonderful experience. And so that sort of opened the door to a 2000 when Steve called me and he said, I'm with Cameron McIntosh and we're just curious, can high schools do Les Mis? Do you want to take a stab at it? And I said, I'll call you back. So I had to ask my team. We had already cast another show, actually, but this was obviously going to be good. And I called down my seniors, some of them who were cast in the other show. And I said, you know, guys, we have an opportunity to do something brand new and no one has ever done it. And, you know, do you want to be part of the first high school test production of Les Mis? And they, of course, all said yes.
I was going to say, no.
So the next thing was I went into the city the next day to meet Steve. And Cameron McIntosh was in his office as well. And he said, I want the show to be 2.5 hours. I said, how long is it now? He said, 3:07. I said, wow, that's specific. And he said, well, 3:10, I have to start paying overtime.
Oh.
So, all right, okay. But he said 3:07 because most people, especially with dramas, he said, with comedies, people don't mind laughing a little longer. But when you're dealing with drama, the show should be over 10 minutes before everyone wished it was done, and not 10 minutes after they wished you stopped.
Oh, so true.
And you can feel it at 2.5 hours. So he said, for amateur theater, especially school theater, it should always be done a little sooner than you wished. So I want you to cut it down to 2.5 hours. And he gave me this score, 3-ring binder that was gigantic. And I said, what song should I cut? And he said, you can't cut any songs. You got to cut pieces of every song.
Oh, okay. I have a question. Did you cut the confrontation? Were you like the person that like decided which parts of that stay?
I was a team. I worked with Tim McDonald and a musical director, David Weinstein, I believe, was helping us. And my musical director at school, John Farrell, was instrumental in putting a lot of that together as well. And I will tell you, the bottom line is, at the end of our show, and one of Cameron's assistants said to me, if he doesn't stay for the whole show, don't be offended. He might have liked what he saw. And he'll, so if he's not there after intermission, don't be upset. He stayed for the whole show.
Wow.
I had my spies in the audience. He started the standing ovation at the end for the kids, which they were thrilled with.
Oh, my goodness.
And he stayed for an hour afterwards speaking with them. And,
wow.
Especially complimenting my stage crew, which I was very happy that he did that because they worked very hard and they don't get the recognition that they deserve. Stage crew kids, you know, are the heart or the backbone of what we do. So it's really important. But he did walk up to me after all was said and done, and he tapped his watch and he said, 2:37. And I said, yeah, I know. I knew it was going to be a little longer. My confrontation was actually a little bit longer. There was a cute little musical moment that when Jean Valjean goes up and picks up young Cosette from the Thénardiers and they're leaving, there's a nice little counter melody with the two of them doing the la, 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 la.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought it was just a gorgeous little piece of music. So I left it just because I liked it. But and the confrontation, he said, the point is made. You can, more cuts can be made here. And my stars was a little bit longer as well. He said,
okay.
He's the bad guy. That's what we need to know. So more cuts were made. So they wanted to test it. In fact, I remember him saying, I want to make sure, you know, I did have strong voice and it was a good production. We changed the key for Bring Him Home from A to F because A is undoable for most high school boys. And we used a live pit, which was great, except for one of our trumpet players, I think, got hit in the mouth with a lacrosse ball.
Oh, no.
So, you know, because the other was high school theater. So there's world things you do you don't deal with anywhere else. But nonetheless, that was fun. So then they said, well, we need to see another school do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a dear friend teaching in Levittown, Pennsylvania, Lou Volpe. And I said, call Lou, see if he's got strong voice this year. And he did. And we sort of had a... his school was green and white. His school was on Cherry Street. My school was on Cherry Lane. It's like we had a parallel universe.
That's so funny.
So he did take it on. And then I believe at the same time, Helen Hayes Youth Theater up in Westchester did it. So he really went up. And I follow that same model. If I have a show that I think is going to do well with schools, I will want to see more than just one do it.
Sure. Yeah.
See that it works. So you saw last year was the result of the second. The first school who saw West Orange High School do Bright Star.
Right.
Then Rockbridge High School called me and they said, we have a more multi-ethnic cast at our school. A little bit of a different concept that we'd like to do it. So it's not a replica production of Broadway. And again, what made the school, there's no bad words that had to be changed. Sometimes I'll ask an author, you know, if there's a word that's going to keep a show from being done. And best example of that would be when we had Eric Idle here and talking about Spamalot. And I said, Spamalot's not dirty, it's naughty. And he looked, he said, what's naughty about it? And I said, well, the word shit, for example, life's a piece of shit when you think of it. He said, what's wrong with shit? Shit is shit. I said, no, not in America.
Oh.
In America, that's a word that teachers are not going to be allowed to use in most parts of the country. There are schools in New York and LA and Chicago who can get away with it. But in the Bible Belt, most of the schools cannot. In religious schools, they certainly cannot. And he thought it was amusing. I think he said they don't, high school students in America don't use the word shit. And I said, no, they use it.
Yeah, right. They use it.
Do they read it in books? I said, yeah, they do that too.
But they can't say it out loud.
I said, just trust me, I'm telling you, they can't use it on stage. So I said, if I change shit to dong, we're going to be fine. I said, yes, we'll get definitely more licensing. And he said, fine. So we went through it and he changed lyrics. But if you know the show Spamalot, there's wonderful lead characters throughout the show. And I also said the other question. So sometimes I'll point out where there are problematic words and is the author willing to give an alternative? Because sometimes I will say to the author, teachers are going to change it anyway, so why don't you give an approved change?
Yeah, that's so smart. Yeah.
Or if there's something you absolutely don't want changed, let me know because then I can point that out. So in the case of Spamalot, Eric Idle said Prince Herbert is this wonderful little character. And he's doubled, of course. He doesn't have to be the not dead Fred. He could be separate. Kids can play that in high school if you want. But... Lancelot gets this missive that he thinks he's going to rescue a damsel in distress at Swamp Castle.
Yeah.
And then he shows up to Swamp Castle and he sees this odd little prince.
Mm-hmm.
You've come to save me. And Lancelot's not quite sure until he meets him, and then he also meets his father, which is pretty much the main villain in Spamalot.
Right, yeah.
Prince Herbert's father, who wants to kill him, and actually attempts to kill him. And when Lancelot goes to defend Herbert, Herbert's father looks at Lancelot and says, "Oh my God, you're gay." And at that point, you move into the Lancelot Likes to Dance a Lot number, which is the parody of The Boy from Oz with Hugh Jackman. And in the school edition, we didn't do it as overt as it was on Broadway, but I thought what I really liked in the high school, first time I did the high school edition out in a school in Hicksville, Long Island, Hicksville High School, they removed the tabard of Lancelot and he was wearing a rainbow t-shirt. Kids loved the number, but it was just a fun number. And at the very end of the show, King Arthur marries the Lady of the Lake, and Robin pronounces his love of musical theater.
Mm-hmm.
And then Lancelot and Herbert come down arm in arm, and Lancelot says, "Just think, in 1,000 years, this will still be controversial." And it gets a great laugh.
Uh-huh.
So Eric said, that cannot be changed. Herbert is, the gender of Herbert is male, whether he's played by a boy or a girl, he doesn't care. There are four characters in Spamalot whose gender is male: King Arthur, Sir Lancelot, Sir Galahad, and Prince Herbert. Everyone else is a person. Question number two, after questionable language, is what roles are gender neutral or swappable, or because every high school theater program has more girls than boys.
Right.
And most musicals have more male leads than female leads. Whenever I see a show that has four or five female leads, and if they have solos, that's jewel for me.
Right. Grab that now.
And then on top of that, if it has 8 to 12 chorus numbers, that's gold. Because again, most seasoned veteran theater teachers will tell you if a show has a lot of chorus numbers, the cast is on stage more times than they're not. And the busier they are on stage, the less drama there is off stage.
Yeah.
So,
very important.
So when I saw All Shook Up, just as Steve was starting TRW, and I thought, oh my God, five female leads with solos and all these chorus numbers. And you got the Shakespeare connection too.
Yeah.
It was loosely based.
It's like one of my favorite shows to do with students.
And the choral arrangements were glorious.
Oh, end of act one, like Can't Fall in Love with You? Unbelievable.
To me, that end of act one of All Shook Up was just as powerful and as fun as the end of act one of Liv is. You know, because that one day.
Yeah, right.
It was just a wonderful moment. So, so after Les Mis went on to become a thing for the school edition, in 2005, Steve Spiegel called me and he said he's always wanted to start his own company and he got funding and he's going to start a new company called Theatrical Rights Worldwide and would I come work with him? And truthfully, I thought after Les Mis that I would take early retirement and go work with him at MTI when he was still president there. But now he started his own company here. So it's been really quite fun. And so as he found me to test shows, now I go and find other schools to test shows. And I work with the authors to make their shows as doable as possible.
Yeah.
If there's something that's going to be a problem. In the case of some shows, it means making it the key changes. Like in Brightstar School Edition, as I said, there are no words that need to be changed, but there are a few keys. Jimmy Ray sings this song, Heartbreaker, which is a killer song. We took it down a full step for high school.
Okay.
Girls.
It is so high.
And I don't believe anything else. Again, that's between Dylan and the musical director at the show.
We'll sure.
figure out the exact final keys of things. In certain cases, there might be a dance number where we'll cut some of the dance music if it's ridiculously long. Broadway equity dancers are different from high school, especially high school boys. But sometimes we've actually had people who said, we're lucky enough that we have a dance program at our school, so we want to have the original, and could we have the Broadway dance arrangement in it and insert it into the school edition? And we've done that on a few occasions.
Oh, that's
rarely,
so nice.
Though, most people appreciate the fact that it's not as long.
Right, because, sometimes you get just, as a choreographer, sometimes I'm like, I don't know what to do because they're done at this point.
We can just do that same section again, or we could just cut it.
Exactly.
And again, if you want to follow that model of a show should be done 10 minutes before everybody wished it was over, and 10 minutes after they wish you had stopped.
Exactly.
Then those are the spots where you can trim something, if you can. And sometimes I've had teachers call and ask for very specific requests about cutting something? And, you know, sometimes the answer is yes and sometimes it's no. But I always ask the teachers, ask first.
Yes.
You'll be surprised what people are willing to do.
Well, and I really appreciate the workshop that I took from you and ITF was that was like the main thing is just ask, right? Like just come up and ask. It wasn't like you were be like, there's sometimes I take workshops about copyright and it's like very like obtrusive and like very like harsh. And I'm like, but that's not going to be helpful because that just scares teachers away. And I like the approach that you guys take to it here of just like, just ask us and let's see what we can do. Because yeah, like every school across America has different challenges that they come up with these scripts. Mm-hmm. I think it's important that I love that you guys are working with the authors proactively as well.
Oh, yeah. And in the case of some teacher in California who actually did ask, she said, I need to make Prince Herbert female. And Eric Isle said, absolutely not.
Mm-hmm.
But I already knew the answer was going to be that. And because he said, that's not even a political statement. It's an observation. It's just an observation that happens to be true.
If you take it as a political statement, that might be your own thing.
As a comedy writer, it's also a great punchline. It gets a great laugh every time the show is done. So I put very clearly in the school edition script, this cannot be changed. And so that people know. And when I did bring up that school in California, he said, tell them to do another show.
That's, wow.
And I agree with that.
Yeah.
Andrew Lippa was at one of our teacher conferences. I think he was we had him as a guest artist at the New York State Theater Teachers Conference. And somebody said, I'm going to be doing the Addams Family. And, you know, what advice do you have? And I loved his advice because it was simply, please, please do the show that we wrote. So we worked a long time getting this. He said, we worked on it really hard and long to make it be what we want it to be before the first national tour. So the version of the Addams Family that you see now mm-hmm. is the result of the author still working on the show while it was on Broadway.
Oh, okay. So I saw it on Broadway.
The Broadway cast album does not match. There are four songs that were cut. Andrew Lippa wrote four brand new songs. They reworked the book. The ensemble, the Dead Ancestors, when I saw the show on Broadway, Act One, I said, oh, this is going to be so much fun. I can't wait to do this.
Yeah.
And then the Ancestors just sort of disappeared. And they've created a sort of a Greek chorus of the Ancestors.
Yeah.
So they're on stage. They could be on stage almost all night if you want them to be. And it is just, I worked on a production in Levittown, on Long Island, in MacArthur High School with the teacher there. She was, they had a great time. And one of their students' father worked at a funeral parlor, so he loaned them a hearse that was in front of the school, in front of the theater with their poster hanging off the hearse for Addams Family. But the kids had a great time because the chorus was on stage most of the night. You know, mm-hmm. they expanded the Dead Ancestors chorus a little bit. And another show with, if Pugsley is a girl playing a boy, but if, because Pugsley's written for an unchanged boy's voice.
Yeah.
And if you have that, you know, short freshman girl who's got a good voice and a good sense of humor, mm-hmm. it's important about the comic timing, it's important.
Right.
So she, if you have a freshman girl play Pugsley, then you've got, again, I think four or five female leads. And I've actually seen productions where Fester was played by a girl.
Oh, interesting.
Because Fester is very sexually ambiguous anyway. And the hardest character we had casting in that one was Lurch, because you don't expect Lurch to come out singing the 11 o'clock number. You can't just pick a basketball player because he's tall and just have him walk around and grunt all night. He's also going to be able to sing that song. And it's sort of funny, a lot of people that do the Addams Family and have Lurch, and he sings that, you know, Move Toward the Darkness, have gone on to do Big Fish, and then Lurch played Carl the Giant. So Andrew Lippa made roles for bases.
There you go.
12 bases that didn't have roles before. He provided.
So do you know why he continued to evolve the script once it went off Broadway?
They thought it could be better. You know, theater is a living, breathing thing and it evolves. And one of the advantages is the fact that with us, we print on demand. So no one ever returns their scripts to us, so they don't have to be reused. And it's a little more costly as far as material is concerned because we don't get to reuse the material.
Right.
But it also enables an author to say, I'm changing the name of this character.
Oh.
So the next time we print it, it's changed.
And so what came up? Like, so where did that idea of not returning the materials come from? Like, and why do you guys have that?
When we were starting the company, Steve said, and I love the fact that he asked to have somebody with educational experience on board here.
Mm-hmm.
Because he said, what were the things that bothered you most as a theater teacher? And I said, number one, truthfully, erasing scripts. That would be like the horrible job to give freshmen on stage crew after a show closed, because for some reason, especially when you're bringing ringers in the pit, you know, I would use students and then teachers and professional friends of mine who would come into play. And it made life a lot easier to have a professional woodwind and brass in the brass and woodwind section, because then they help the kids individually in the pit rather than you have to stop all the time to fix things. But they never erase their books. So, you know, poor freshmen would have to sit with erasers and erase scripts before we returned the box. And then it's always people losing their scripts. So it was erasing the scripts, racing to get them back to UPS to get them back in time, and then never getting your full deposit check back because you did lose a few along the way. Or we get a note that you didn't fully erase, you're not getting your money back. So Steve said, well, let's see if we can do print on demand. And it took some time because there were certain people afraid that shows would be easier to steal if you didn't demand that it be returned. You know, it's our goal that you let the students keep their script. They can highlight, they can write their notes, they can write their blocking.
What a cool thing to be able to keep with you.
Keep it as a souvenir or recycle it. But, you know, I mean, forget one show. I did a show once where we found a mistake in the score, and I can't remember which company it was. But I do remember I said to everybody in the pit, it was like a C sharp should have been a C natural, or a C natural should have been a C sharp. And I said, don't change that because that was a mistake. We'll make it easy for the next person. And the company said, you didn't erase. And I said, well, I didn't erase because I was correcting a mistake in the score.
Yeah.
I said, that's not your job.
Oh my gosh. Well, and everybody knows like the scores are just so full of mistakes.
Well, especially back in the day when they were handwritten.
Oh gosh, yes.
When I was starting, now they're all computerized as well. So you can fix them easier.
Yeah.
But when you have certain shows where the lyrics and the score don't match the lyrics in the script. And that's, you know, Dylan is scrupulous about, you know, making sure that they do match. And sometimes somebody will call and say, did you know there is something wrong? And like I said, because we don't have to store things, if someone were to call and say that there's a C sharp that should be C natural, we can fix it.
That's so nice.
And the next time it goes out, it's fixed. But because of that, authors can, you know, adapt and change and fix things. But for Adams, we never adapted. We never used the Broadway version because we knew the authors were adapting it before the first national tour.
Oh, okay.
And the first national tour, which I believe was supposed to be out for a year, stayed out for 3 years. And I would always know on Monday where the tour was because I would get calls from Oklahoma. I want to do the Addams Family. Can we do it soon? And, you know, wherever this, and I'd look and say, oh, yeah, that's where they were last week. Teachers from that state. And by the time the Addams Family tour had come to an end, I had over 1,000 groups on a wait list.
Oh, my gosh.
So obviously, the authors knew what they were doing with that. And they're just fun, lovely human beings as well. Andrew Lipper, Marshall Berkman, and Rick Ellis. They just, they have a great sense of humor. And they enjoy working. It's just, I love the energy when they're together. It's, you can feel it. So it's been quite fun. So we've adapted now our Young at Part as our junior. Adam is Young at Part. It's doing very well in middle schools right now as well.
Okay. And so how many, so is Young at Part, is that newer? Like a newer program that you guys have, or?
We've had it for a few years now.
Okay.
Yeah. So you and Young at Part is middle school. So it's like the junior brand. And we're doing Younger at Part.
Okay.
It's going to be 35-minute elementary school musicals.
I love that.
The first big one that was done was Miss Nelson is Missing, because kids know the book and it's fun. And so it's 35 minutes and you can use 30 kids. I think everybody gets to speak.
Wonderful.
Or sing.
Yeah.
One or the other. And all of the keys are kids-friendly ranges. And when Dylan does the guide vocals tracks, he actually records with school children doing the singing.
Oh, how nice.
So kids aren't listening to adult actors singing the roles.
Right.
They're listening to other kids. And then we've worked with, when you went to festival, did you meet Paul Kanin from the original?
Yeah, he actually, I just interviewed him. He'll be on, his episode airs next week. So, yeah.
I love the video they did for the Addams Family with Sergio Trujillo. And his whole concept is just marvelous because you're seeing the choreographer speak. You're seeing the choreographer being adapted to your level. And then while you watch dance captains and former actors perform, I love that when they record it the second time, and they're facing upstage, because then you can practice along as if you're in the back row. So we're creating that for every one of our Young at Parts.
Wow.
Because a lot of times the middle school shows, you're not lucky enough to have a person with theater education training, and I've met many music teachers. One teacher said to me, I'm a math teacher, but when my principal found out I was in a musical in high school, I became the most theatrically literate person on the faculty. So I'm in charge.
Oh, no.
So she needs to have those resources. So Paul is quite helpful for that as well. And then the guys from Rocks with the tracks, for the rehearsal tracks as well as the guide vocals tracks. I find that very helpful. And then we've hooked up with BMD, Quentin, who does those projections. And I first found him, was at a production of The Addams Family in a theater on Long Island, because one of my former students was playing Fester. And I was amazed at the projections that I was seeing. And it's a very small space, actually, with not fly space. And I said, Frank, where did you get those projections? You guys must have some big budget. And he said, those projections cost me less than renting 3 backdrops.
Wow.
Sorry, where did you get them? He told me this company out in California. And I called and met Quentin Sanford. And we have done a partnership where he does most of our shows now.
Wow.
And then Quentin is now creating digital backdrops, which is basically one slide per scene for all of our younger parts as well.
Oh, how nice is that?
Because his slides are moving slides. It's like moving
slides.
Right,
yeah.
When I was watching The Addams Family, there was like ghosts cracking out of cracks in the wall and the eyeballs on the pictures moving on the...
That's
on
so
the
cool.
You know, so again, my goal is to... If I see a resource that would have been really helpful to me when I was teaching... Mm-hmm. I try to connect that to as many people as possible.
That's amazing.
Of course, it has to fit in your budget, but there are certain things that, you know, I would do an improv show to raise money for projections if I needed to do. I mean,
right. Well, I think that's like something too, like a lot of the teachers that I work with across the country, like we talk a lot about like how to spend your time and where to spend your time, because they're putting so much into trying to like use the musical as their only source of funding, but that limits you so much then, because then you're stuck in that constant trap of like, you have to then produce these big name musicals. You can't ever diversify. Whereas like, if you could do a smaller show and then you'd have more time to do things like an improv show for fundraising or even a cabaret. That's like my favorite thing when I was teaching was like, put on a cabaret, do that to raise money.
You have to be careful when you're putting on a cabaret.
Correct. Correct.
It must be a cabaret, not in costume, not with characters, not with scenes.
Yep. They just got to be the kids singing.
Right.
And
which, again, because you don't want to be caught with someone sharing video of you doing something that you eventually, you know, could be questioned about.
Mm-hmm.
So the rules for cabarets, that could be a whole other blog.
Oh, yeah. That's a whole other thing that you could talk about for sure.
And the whole copyright part of that, but you're totally right. See, for me, I never ever once did a musical to make money.
Oh, okay. So how did you make your money then?
The musical was not my fundraiser. If anything, my musical, I was thrilled if we broke even.
So how did you do it?
We never did programs. We didn't sell ads for programs because in my school, the sports pretty much sold all the ads for the programs.
So. Sure.
And I was told do not be hitting up the same sponsors twice by the sports people and the yearbook people, too.
Yeah.
Also using the same ones. And personally, I didn't have the time for it.
Yeah, it's a lot of work.
I did not have a business manager.
Mm-hmm.
I was very lucky. We had a full-time dance teacher on the faculty. We had a full-time musical director. You know, we had a 4-year curriculum in theater.
Unbelievable.
And dance, because they took dance as their phys ed credit. And we had a phenomenal costume staff as well. One of our theater teachers who taught classical theater in junior year. He also was a costume designer. His team did beautiful work as well. But, you know, we have to rent costumes. It's expensive. And wireless microphones is crazy expensive to rent. And even bringing in additional lighting. So for me, the musical was a celebration of the biggest thing we're going to do in the course of the year.
Sure.
But it certainly was not the fundraiser. We raised funds with our improv shows and our Christmas concert-show. Sometimes some of our smaller shows that had less overhead actually made small profits.
Okay.
The musical was expensive.
Actually. Yeah.
Again, I never tell people to think that they're going to make money on a musical. And certainly all administrators should know that.
Well, and that's like the tough part. Those administrators don't realize how much money it actually costs to put on shows, and that you really need to be paying your staff Like there's one school I worked with where the teacher was getting, like, they had a budget of like 3,000 and that had to also include her pay and rights. And it just is interesting. Cause like, yeah, administrators need to realize like actually like what it is we're supposed to be doing with the arts in high schools. Right.
These are moments that I was at a 35-year reunion 2 weeks ago. And it's funny when you go because it's like they were together 3 weeks ago, you know, like when they all start talking, because theater bonds people in a way that other things don't.
Right.
And they're still talking, you know, at 30 or 35 years later, they talk about going to Thespian Festival or the specific shows that they did and how it led to them doing any number of things. Some were doctors and some were teachers. A lot were teachers, actually. Some went on to performing and some leave it for a while. The importance of arts education, I believe, is the main spot in school where empathy is being learned. And we're living in a society right now that is desperately in need of empathy, education, and that when we live in other people's shoes and we see the world through other people's eyes, it causes us to have a bigger view of other human beings. You know, when you do theater, you learn about stuff. As I said to theater teachers, you don't know, you're going to be a master at stuff that you have no idea right now. Because if you go on and you do, I did Arthur Miller's Playing for Time, you know, and I learned about the women who were playing in an orchestra at Auschwitz, because when people were being unloaded to the prison, they were playing music to calm them somewhat. And so long as you could keep playing, you could keep living. Hence the title, Playing for Time.
Wow.
And it's a totally true story. So we had to do all of this research to learn all of these people are and who they were. And, you know, and they were girls from 14, you know, to women who were in their 20s and 30s. One of this woman, I remember, she was the niece of Gustav Mahler, the composer, who the story was. That was a long, long time ago. But I remember that had a profound effect because, and some of them were at this reunion. That's where I remember.
Okay, yeah.
The piece. I remembered one of the things I did was I said to the girls who were going to be the orchestra, and they were sophomores, juniors, and seniors, I said, take your instruments, and here is the piano score to Eine kleine Nacht music by Mozart. For the first 2 weeks of rehearsals, you are not to meet us at all. You are to go to the band room, and you must put together an orchestra. And in 2 weeks, you better come in here, and we'll tell you whether or not we think you would have lived. Because if you're playing for your life, you're playing for your role. And if you're not, I said, I had no intention of really cutting anybody. But I said, well, if you don't play like you sound like you, creating a small orchestra, you're out of the cast. So they were playing for their role, but they did it.
Wow.
I said, do you understand now? And you get to go home every night and sleep and eat a good meal. But these people were starving and they were sick or they were scared. But they were able to put together an orchestra to keep themselves living, hopefully, till the end of the war. And some of them did and some of them didn't. And that's the story. But you pick us something like that historically, you learn, you know, you have to do your homework and you learn these characters. And those are characters that those actors played that they never forgot. We play these roles and we learn from them. And we bring ourselves to them. And, you know, I just think it's a very important. It's a shame when I hear things like at the EDT Teachers Conference, someone said they 25% or less of the schools in New York City have theater. And that's really, that's tragic because kids of all levels, you know, are learning so much. When I was starting out, before I had my program, that we could do 10 shows a year, we were just doing one and then two. And then three and whatever. I used to cast kids who didn't even come to audition.
Oh, really? You'd be like, you're in the show.
And kids would say, I announced home basketball and football games just to get myself known on the other side of the building. And I would see certain, I'd say, oh, he'd be good at this. Some kids would go to, hey, I saw you're in the play. What do you mean I'm in the play? I didn't audition. Well, you're on the list.
Oh, my gosh.
And no one ever dropped out.
Wow.
Sometimes you just, you know, don't be afraid to be bold.
Yeah.
And there was the occasional very not strong person who was irritated. Why did you cast the person who didn't audition?
Right.
Because he can do that role.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't. You know, and when you cast a student in a role that they cannot achieve, and you're setting them up for failure, that's on you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we all do it from time to time. I cast a girl once in a role that she was what was beyond her vocal range.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew it. I was hoping that, I don't know what I was hoping for, a miracle or whatever, but it didn't happen. And she came up to me. Ultimately, we ended up changing the song. She said, "You have to change the song because if not, you're embarrassing me."
Oh, wow.
And she was right.
Yeah.
I said, "I'm sorry, you're right. You're totally right.
Mm-hmm.
It's my fault. You have to fix it." So that's why I talk about casting is so important.
Yeah. I mean, it is. And that's, I love how at the beginning, what you were saying at the beginning of the podcast about like making sure you pick the show for the students you have and not for what you want to do. Because I mean, that's like, I guess that's a dramaturg. Like that's like my big thing also from a like emotional, social, emotional learning standpoint. And like picking the show for what you have talent wise is like, you have to, but then also like, what are you going to be able to do that's going to really help your students grow as humans and as performers, right? Because, I mean, if you're picking it for who you have, it's obviously going to help them grow as a performer. But also, what is important in your students' lives and in your community? And how can you connect those things so that your students are able to, like, actually get a, like, maximum impact from the work that you're creating?
That's absolutely right. And another interesting thing about why I like, first quarter of my Theater One class was always just do improv for the whole first quarter.
Mm-hmm.
Because part of the process of that is one of the most important rules of improvisation is you have to make your partner look good.
Yep.
You know, you always get those few kids. I always say, my four types of kids that I've seen in improv is those ones who just come in, just like you have those kids who can open their mouth and they sing. And I said, how do you do that? I don't know. I just do it.
Mm-hmm.
And those dancers who can just pick up a combination. It was always my big fear. When yeah. That was my weakness as an actor. And I'm amazed at how quickly certain people can pick up dance. And there are those that just get it. They're just so naturally funny.
Mm-hmm.
Which one of the pleasures of meeting Eric Idle in person was I realized as just listening to him speak, he's not trying to be funny. He is funny. He's not trying to entertain me. He's entertaining himself. And I'm lucky enough to be along for the ride.
Oh, yeah.
And you
yeah.
see those kids that uh-huh. are just naturally have this way of looking at life through a different angle.
Mm-hmm.
Then they go, or you have good actors who want to do improv, but they're not great at it yet.
Mm-hmm.
And they just, you have to have patience and then just let them do it over and over again. Then you have those who are terrified.
Yep. That was me.
They're terrified.
Improv, I'm so scared.
Give me a script.
Yep.
But don't make me just make up something on my own.
Exactly.
You know, what's going to happen is someday you're going to have a script and you're going to go blank. And you better have that skill
mm-hmm.
to quickly come up with something. And those ones who are terrified, they're fine. So long as, again, you have patience. I never forced anybody in an improv show. And anybody could always put their arm out and tag themselves out if they, like,
oh, somebody. Okay.
So somebody would jump in and take over the role. But those shy ones, you know, those are those kids. They do theater because they're shy. And theater gives them an opportunity to be in front of people, but with rules and
right.
lines. And ultimately, they can be okay, and some of them become very good improvisers.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have that last group, which is the kids that, look at me, look at me, look at me, like the center of attention ones.
Mm-hmm.
They don't understand. It's not about look at me. It's about I need to make my partner look good. So those ones can be annoying at first because they think they're the center of attention. But they have the skills. They just need to put that energy in the right place.
Yeah.
And when they all learn that my goal is to make my partner look good, and knowing that sometimes my partner is shy and sometimes my partner is overdoing it, and I'm going to tag them out for their own good.
Yeah.
I love it when somebody would just see this, have this quirky thought or an idea, and they jump in and they just insert it into an improv scene. But the notion of I must make my partner look good ties over to every single show you'll ever work on.
That's acting 101. Like that's like the bait where we have to start when we teach kids how to act. And that's so interesting because like so many of like people when I go around this country doing like workshops with young people, like that's just like a concept that's like never even been talked about. Like the most important person on stage is not yourself. It's your partner. And if your partner doesn't look good, you don't look good. Or if you do look good, you can't. That's not okay either, because you look really
funny. Well, you're also lucky because to your partner, you're the most important person.
Exactly. So you get that like validation back, but it can't be just coming from you.
Right.
Yeah.
So for us actors, it's our goal to serve the piece.
Mm-hmm.
It's our goal to make the piece look good.
Yes.
And to serve the author.
Yeah.
Which brings me right back to like what I said, what Andrew Lippa said was to all of the teachers, please, please do the show that we wrote.
Yes.
We do not need you to rewrite our show. We do not need you to reconceive our show.
Yeah.
We're proud of it. We're happy with it. Just do it. And I would dare say most authors would say the same thing. And if you have to change it for some reason, you know, like I said, ask.
Mm-hmm.
And you might get a good answer. Sometimes authors will say, oh, I never thought about that. Or this worked for this period, but this doesn't work in 2019 or 2020.
Sure.
So I will rethink that.
Oh, okay. Which is great, because times do change. And it's great that you guys have the opportunity at TRW to, like, because you're printing on demand, make those changes more easily, for sure.
And sometimes we'll actually make the change in Ghost, for example.
Mm-hmm.
We made a small cast version.
Oh.
Because Ghost on Broadway was this gigantic.
Massive
extravaganza with a whole LED wall and a lot of choreography and stuff. But ultimately, it's a love story.
Mm-hmm.
It's a love story between Sam and Molly and this wonderful relationship with this Otome psychic character. And it's sweet and it's lovely. And everybody who's seen the movie certainly remembers the love story of that movie. And as soon as they hear Unchained Melody, they remember how they felt at the end. So it elicits tears for those who saw it. But what I love about that show is high school kids today mostly don't know that movie.
Right.
So Akron, Firestone High School in Akron, Ohio, mm-hmm. Mark Zimmerman and his team put on the first high school production of Ghost. And what blew me away was the kids, first of all, boys and girls, both crying at the end. It was a good date night kind of show. And when they discovered that Carl was the villain, like his best friend actually set him up, there was verbal anger out of the audience.
Oh, I love when that happens.
I said, wow, they don't know the movie. So they don't know what's coming. The parents, of course, did.
Right.
But it was quite fun to watch the whole process there go. But rather than to have all of these special effects,
right,
we created this simpler version where, you know, once we know Sam is dead,
yeah,
and Mark did a beautiful job of, you know, Sam is they're confronted by the guy who's going to, the mugger, who's going to rob him, and then he accidentally shoots him and kills him. But rather than, so he confronted him downstage left, he drops the gun, which we hear, and then Sam moved upstage right, and he fell to the ground, and this crowd comes in, and of course, what you don't see is in the crowd, somebody just downstage of Sam is lying down in front of his body. So then, wearing exactly the same clothes, so then Sam could stand up from behind the crowd, and he walks away. But we know, so we all as an audience know Sam is dead. If you've seen the movie, of course, you know Sam is dead.
Right,
but
yeah.
But even if you didn't,
yeah,
Sam is dead. So that means we don't need special effects to move things across the room. Sam can just pick it up and move it. And we understand that no one on stage can see Sam.
Yes.
And it eliminated very expensive special effects.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked. So making a smaller cast edition makes the show more doable in smaller spaces.
Mm-hmm.
And less high tech makes it more doable. So that's another thing we try to adapt. Big Fish has the Broadway version, we've got, yeah, the high school edition, uh-huh, and we've got the small cast edition.
Oh, okay.
Which all three seem to be doing well. My favorite version of it is the school edition, which Texas Thespians did.
It's so great.
They just did a beautiful, beautiful adaptation. Scott Taylor was the director for the Texas Thespians, and Bobby Steggert, who played Will on Broadway, came to their Stay Festival.
Oh, my gosh.
And Scott did a beautiful thing that, because he played Will, the son.
Uh-huh.
And Scott had Will standing in the periphery of all of the fantastical stories that Edward was telling little Will.
Mm-hmm.
Because we realized Big Fish is Will's story. It's not Edward's. it's about Edward, but it's Will's story. And he thought, he said, hey, that's good. He says, I wish I got to do that. You know, like,
oh, yeah.
Will was on stage more than he was in the Broadway production.
Okay.
But it worked. It totally made sense with what they did. And he liked that. They did their own production. They weren't doing a replica production. And
yeah.
In the same way when we did the Georgia Thespians did Memphis as their all stage show.
Okay.
Because it's a, you know, beautiful, powerful story.
Right.
And Joe DiPietro had a ticket to come down to see it at the Georgia State Festival. And we had a blizzard here in New York.
Oh, no.
And I went down to see it for Tech Week.
Okay.
Well, Tech 2 days for State Festival.
You know, right.
All of Tech Week is really a day and a half. And I actually sent Joe a little clip of the boy, Cody, who was singing Memphis in Me. And he just, you know, he texted back, I can't wait, because we were all excited. The author was coming down. And then we had this storm in New York, and he waited and waited, and the LaGuardia eventually canceled his flight. He wasn't going to get in until after the show had closed anyway. But fortunately, we figured a way of streaming it from the theater to Joe's apartment.
Okay.
And then after the show, my phone buzzed, and it was him saying, I need to talk to them. So I took my iPad on FaceTime backstage.
Uh-huh.
So Joe met the cast met Joe. But one of the first things he said was, who's the choreographer? And I pointed over to Richard Fraser, who's the choreographer. And he said, congratulations, you guys did your own show. I was expecting to see people try to copy the Broadway show.
Mm-hmm.
You did not. You made your own show. And I say that also to the theater teachers. Don't be afraid to do your own thing.
Mm-hmm.
You have the script, you have the scores, you have the parts. The blocking from Broadway is not something that you have.
Right.
You don't have necessarily a right to even use it.
Right.
And sadly, YouTube is homogenizing American musical theater. Like, everybody thinks it's got to always be done the same way.
Yes.
And what the biggest compliment that Joe DiPietro said was, you did a completely powerful, legitimate, authentic version of Memphis, exactly as written, that did not copy somebody else's blocking of it. And, you know, I'd say that it's a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard work. Hard work isn't easy. You know,
right.
That's what they call it, hard work. So
yes.
it's sometimes easier to just copy.
Mm-hmm.
But get to a point where you can have, you know, a team in place to do your own thing. And I think that Yale's something to be more proud of.
Absolutely.
You know, that's important.
Mm-hmm. For sure. So I have two questions, and then we'll wrap up, because this has been super great. So my first one is, so you see theater all over the country. You've seen, like, probably more theater than most people will ever consume in their lifetime combined on this podcast. So do you have any examples of time, like the most impactful time that theater you've seen it change either the students that were involved or the community at large, like where the theater was able, the piece that was being performed was able to bring people together in ways that was, like, really impactful?
Yes.
Okay.
The first one deals with Memphis.
Okay.
When I was at the Georgia Thespian Festival the year we did Memphis as their all state show. And first of all, I thought I was very impressed, and it was courageous on their part in parts of Georgia where there are still segregated schools, that they're doing a state show that is 60% black and 40% white. And there are kids who would have only known each other because their schools competed in football or basketball, and now they're working together on one project.
Mm-hmm.
The morning after the show, I was walking down to teach a workshop, and I had worked with the kids. I knew them all at that point, who were in the cast, and I was moved to tears by the production. It was just so beautiful and so powerful. Which I also think is why Joe wanted to actually physically FaceTime them after.
Yeah.
Because he was also as moved as I was by the experience. And I saw these two boys sitting on a bench, white kid and a black kid. And the one black kid, he looked up at me, and they were just so tired. But I said to them, you know, that in fact, after I said, you guys, you're going to go experience something that I call joyful exhaustion. You're going to be so tired, but so happy that you're so tired because you earned it. You mm-hmm. earned that joyful exhaustion. And that's why we do it. That's why we do it again. And he looked up at me and he just said, I said, how do you guys feel? I said, we feel good. He said, we did something really important last night, didn't we? I said, yes, you did. Because those two guys would have even known each other. And here they bonded as relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other is this exact same show. In Texas, there were two schools in the Houston area, a black school and a white school. They combined schools to do, and they were normally big sports rivals.
Oh.
They combined schools to do a bi-school version of Memphis.
Mm-hmm.
And also beautifully done version of the show. And the show really ended up and created not just friendships, but actual inter-school prom dates.
I love that.
And one of the teachers said to me that the certain parents on both sides were not thrilled about that.
Oh.
But that's okay, because that's one of the messages of the show.
Right.
You know, we have to look at people as who they are and get to learn and love and appreciate who they are. That was one. The other was The Color Purple at Northwest School of the Arts in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
I highly recommend the documentary Purple Dreams by Greyhawk Films, which was done about this experience. But this was a school in an art school in Charlotte. Corey Mitchell was a director I'd known for years, and Corey asked me, is there any way, while The Color Purple, the first national tour was out, but he said, I know that I have Seeley, I have Mister, I have Harpo, I have Sophia, and I have a Sugar Avery. And that's to have all five of those that are legit. And he says, and I don't know how many more years that'll happen before they ever come back.
Mm-hmm.
So, but is there any way we could get permission to do a production? And again, that's why I said, don't be afraid to ask. Sometimes
yeah,
you know.
Geez, yeah.
300 people have asked if they can do the prom, and the answer has been no, because they haven't set up their tour yet. So it's restricted.
Sure.
But in this case, the tour was out, and the Michael and Stephen from Phoenix Productions said the tour is actually not going to be near North Carolina at that point, and so they gave permission.
Wow.
And I said, because we want to create a school edition of the show. Because it's a mature subject matter.
Right. It's intense.
And it has to be handled. And we did it pretty intensely, but with certain stage directions to make it work. There was not an ounce of content that was changed.
Wow.
And I don't know if there are any key changes involved. I can't remember, because this was quite a while ago. It must be at least 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But and it's a multi-ethnic school, but it was an all-black cast. And so the mixed race, obviously, in the pit and the crew and everybody else,
mm-hmm.
You know, and Corey meant, he said, you know, like the black students in my school have played Juno Zidane Tefka and Office Workers and How to Succeed or whatever, but I really want to have a show where they can actually play authentic African-American characters. And they rose to this occasion, and it was so intense, the choreography, the show, the sets, the blocking. And when I saw it, I was so profoundly moved by just the beauty of the storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
Corey found humor in the script that I did not remember. And I think the humor made us more tearful, because once you have people laughing, it's easier to make them cry as opposed to not at all. And those kids knew they were doing something special. They were adjudicated and asked to perform at the Thespian Festival main stage. And when I sat there with Corey watching them perform, something unbelievable happened. At the very end of the evening performance curtain call, the kids came out and bowed. And I just saw absolute thick tears streaming from every single kid's face, to the point where we all, just the whole entire audience, I think, all started crying immediately, because it was just so sincere, because you feel that. If you're an empathetic person, you connect when you see those things.
Yeah.
And This boy, Micah, who played Mister, who's just a beautiful kid. I went backstage, you know, we were going to help with the strike and everything. And I said, all right, what happened? And those kids were so in the present with that show, every single performance, which is the dream as a teacher you want to have.
Right.
If you're aware that you're in a performance, you're not really in the performance. And the goal is always that your last performance be the best one, but sometimes it's not.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And any number of things can cause that to happen. Somebody's
right.
sick, somebody's, you know, whatever. But these kids were so much in the present, and most of them were seniors, so that after the audience reaction, and you know the audience reaction at a main stage show at a Thespian Festival
yeah.
is intense.
Insane.
So as soon as the curtain closed at the end of the show, before curtain calls, they all went upstage and they just bundled together. And Micah said, it's graduation, guys. Because they realized. And it was at that moment, because so many of them said to me, it didn't hit me until that second. This is the last time.
Yeah.
So when they turned and then the curtain opened again and they all came for a curtain call, that's what was the... precipitated that moment, and it was just a gorgeous, beautiful moment. You know, but theater changes students' lives in many cases, you know, and the boy who played Harpo, whose name I can't remember off the top of my head, I said to him, I don't want to let go of this. I said to Celia, I said to a number of them, you guys are going to play this again someday. I just have a feeling. Well, he just finished. I think he's currently or just finished being Harpo in the revival tour.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. That's awesome.
Yes.
Wow. Well, and I mean,
you should interview Corey Mitchell.
Yeah.
He'll tell you all the details and the names.
Yeah. That would be amazing because he sounds
like he's
doing. He's
got some extraordinary things going on in his school. And I'm very, you know, very proud of the work that he does. And I love working with him. He's a very interesting person. But that's the cool thing is that I've met some of the most amazing theater teachers who are selfless, willing to exhaust themselves for the sake of their students. I was speaking with a group of teachers once, and I forget where I read it. Yes, I do remember. I remember it was the Greek author Nikos Kazantzakis,
okay.
who said, a teacher is like a bridge, taking their students... enabling the students to go from one place to another, and when all of the last student gets over the bridge, joyfully collapses. And I know so many theater teachers around the country that fit that to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my last bit of advice to a younger teacher is don't peak too early. When you get a show to a certain level, you're going to be expected to be at that level every time out. And that is exhausting.
Yeah.
Build slowly. You know, you don't want to make it every single time out. You're never going to go to main stage every year in a row because, first of all, they don't allow it anymore, which is a good thing.
Right.
It's not just for the variety. I think it's good for the mental health of the teacher in charge.
Well, yeah. So insane. Yeah.
And the pressure of just the fundraising and all of that that's involved. But, take time. Build up slowly and have a really strong support system.
Mm-hmm.
If you can't afford to pay a support system, then at least build one with alumni and parents and friends.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I saw a high school in Indiana did a production of We Will Rock You, which is a totally fun, crazy show.
Yeah.
Nothing serious about that. It's a Footloose meets Mad Max.
Love it.
In this like post-apocalyptic world where nobody talks to each other anymore because they're connected to their devices, which is funny. But again, it was a really great energy. The energy of that show, it changed these kids' whole perception toward, you know, one of the mothers came up to me. She said, my son never liked going to school, but then he got in this show and suddenly... you know, every single day he can't wait. And if he's sick, I have to go. We have rehearsal today. You know, we're giving, in many cases, the kids the reason to show up every day. And yeah, they're going to go through those other things that they may not enjoy as much because they have to earn the right to do the same that they enjoy so much.
Yeah. No, I love that. Yeah. I mean, that's beautiful way to end things. Like you, like teachers are bringing so much joy to the world with the work that they do. And I just thank you for sharing all these stories. They've been like so awesome. I wish we could keep talking for hours.
Thank you.
Because yeah, it's very, really inspirational. Thank you so much for doing this. Is there any other, is there any way that people can find out more? I mean, TRWs, obviously everybody kind of knows, just go to the website. They can find out more about the shows you guys are doing there. Is there any other resources or anything else you'd throw out for any educators that are out there listening?
If you've never done an improv show and you want to know, since I talked a lot about
yes.
I actually wrote the book.
Right. Okay. So how can people find the book? And
it's for sale on the Theater Folk website.
Amazing.
The publisher of it. Lindsay and Craig have published the book, and it teaches teachers how to do an improv show and monitor things so that they don't jeopardize. You know, a lot of people are afraid, I'm not going to do an improv show and let kids say whatever they want.
Yes.
Well, there's a structure to it.
Okay.
That makes it happen. But I said it became for us not only a source of keeping the boys in my program, because there are always girls there, but it became a good fundraising source to get us to festivals and competitions and things like that. So that's one. And if anybody has any questions, you know, they can always reach me at TRW or the next state conference that I'm at. Feel free to ask. And that's my big advice. Always ask.
Yeah, I love that. Well, thank you so much, Jim, again for
You're
joining
welcome.
Me. And we'll see you guys all next week. All right.
All righty.
Bye.
Thank you.
Episode. If you enjoyed it, I would love if you would leave us a review or rate us on iTunes or Stitcher, or share us with your friends on social media so that we are able to help spread the word around Flipping the Script and inspire people to make art that matters across the world. As a thank you for taking the time to review us and share us, each month I'm going to be giving away a Theater Swag gift basket. All that you need to do in order to win is just share us and review us, and every month I'm going to select a review or a share at random, read it on the air, and if it's yours, you will be the lucky winner of this awesome Theater Swag bag, which is going to have so much stuff in it that's like essential for the theater nerd, no matter if you're a teacher or student or just an enthusiast. If you want to find out more about Re Theater and our programs, our online classes, and our community for educators, just go to www.retheaterco.com. Theater is spelled with an R-E. Or you can follow us on Facebook at Re Theater. If you want to know about the work that I'm up to and find out more about Re Theater, you can follow me on Instagram. I'm there all the time giving out lots of tips and ideas and just sharing about how awesome theater education is. You can follow me at @Lindsay_CuiavaBar. If you have any questions about today's episode or thoughts you'd like to share with us, or maybe you have some topics you'd like to see us cover in the future, I would totally love to hear from you. You can send me an email anytime at lindsay@retheaterco.com. Just make sure you spell Lindsay, A-Y, and I look forward to hearing from you. As always, thanks for listening and keep on making art that matters.